Chief Justice Steele, honorable members of the panel, this is a case that involves two convictions of possession of a firearm by a person prohibited, two counts of possession of ammunition and resisting arrest, and for possession of drug paraphernalia. It basically arises out of a traffic stop that took place in May of 2009, and I would submit to the court that it's very fact-specific as it deals with the claimed failure of the trial judge to give a Lally instruction. The motor vehicle stop occurred in the early morning hours. There was a weapon that was found in the car or vehicle. The police at the time of the motor vehicle stop knew who the driver of the vehicle was and knew that he had a history of firearms violations in the past. The appellant was a passenger in the vehicle. The Dover police came out to the scene, seized items from the vehicle, including a shotgun shell in a sock in the rear of the car, and also a skeleton mask. Subsequently, they executed an administrative search warrant and found a shotgun under some stairs in the trailer where the appellant had previously resided. He was, as I indicated, charged with those offenses and convicted after trial. The issues that are presented today for the court are whether the state had a duty through its police officers to preserve the clothing under which the weapon in the car was found and under which the weapon in the mobile home was found in order for the defendant to review those items and make use of them as he saw fit. The other issue is whether there was DNA testing required to be performed, comparing DNA samples of the defendant with swabs that were taken from the shotgun. This court, or the trial judge, denied the Lally instruction after argument at the prayer conference and said that he thought that extending it to DNA testing, the Lally principle to DNA testing, would expand that role to a degree that this court didn't or wouldn't consider appropriate, and didn't think the clothing was of significance in the case. This court has many times discussed the applicability of a Lally instruction, and they determine, or the determination that must be made by the trial court is whether evidence is discoverable. I submit in this case it would be clothing that's seized and is going to be used in conjunction with a prosecution for possession of a firearm by a prohibited person would be discoverable, or photographs of that clothing would be discoverable. Whether the state had a duty to preserve that evidence, I think that that's clear. It's in conjunction with the investigation of the case in this particular matter.
So in this case, the clothing was never seized?
It was never seized nor photographed, Your Honor. So the defendant was deprived the opportunity to look at that clothing and say that it belonged to somebody else.
Why would the police reasonably believe that the clothes piled on top of the weapon in the backseat of the Isuzu would be helpful for a defense?
Well, they knew that the driver of the vehicle had a history of firearms offenses. When they stopped him, they knew he owned the motor vehicle. The weapon was found behind the driver's seat, and it was underneath clothing. There were items in the back that also could conceivably belong to the driver of the vehicle. And any attempt, I mean, it would seem to me that they should preserve that evidence so the defendant can look at it to make a determination as to whom it belongs.
Your point is that it's more likely clothing in a car would belong to the owner of the car than a passenger?
Well, number one, it's his car, so I think you might presume that the items in there belong to him. Number two, it's right behind the driver's seat where it is. So the weapon is found right behind the driver's seat. So is it too much to ask for the police to either take a picture of that or to preserve those items? In a situation such as this, with these serious offenses, I don't think that that's too much to ask. The third item that needs to be considered is whether there was a breach of the duty to preserve and the consequences that shall flow from that breach. Was it negligent to fail to take a picture of these clothing, of this clothing, or to take it into custody and hold it to be examined by counsel for the defendant? I would submit that it is. If it's somebody's car where a weapon is found and it's directly behind that person's seat, I think it's logical that it has some relevance to who either owns or possesses that weapon. The importance of the evidence, well, I would submit to the court that that would have been another link in the chain that showed that this weapon belonged to Andre Reeves. It was found in his car. He had a history of firearms violations, and assuming that it was his clothing, then I think you can make the next step that he's the one that put the weapon there. And I don't think that that's a stretch. The sufficiency of the other evidence to replace that is, or to convict, well, it was a circumstantial case. There was no direct evidence that Mr. Johnson ever possessed either of those weapons that was presented in the trial. So I think there's a real question. As I indicated in the brief, it was a closely contested case, and the jury deliberated for a substantial amount of time before they returned the verdict.
What did the state argue at trial were the facts that supported a reasonable inference that the weapon, even without preserving the clothes, the weapon found in the vehicle belonged to your client and not to the driver?
Was that it was accessible to him because he could reach around into the back seat and grab it, that he attempted to flee the scene, and that they executed an administrative warrant and went back to what had previously been his residence and found a shotgun there and concluded that the handgun had to be his and the shotgun was his because there was some indicia that Mr. Johnson had lived in that mobile home at a time prior to that.
If the clothes that covered the weapon in the car had been preserved, had been examined by you and your client, and he'd said those clothes are not mine, would the state's argument have been any different or any more or less persuasive?
I think it would have been under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, I think that we would have been able to identify those clothes as belonging to Andre Reeves.
Well, if their argument is that the statute satisfied with proximity and access and nothing more, they still went, don't they?
Well, no, because under the definition of constructive possession that was given to the jury, you have to be able to show that he controlled its ultimate destination, what was going to happen to that weapon ultimately. And if it's under somebody else's clothes, I would submit that that's clear, that it shows that the person under whose clothes it has is going to control the ultimate destination of the weapon, especially because the vehicle belonged to Andre Reeves and the state knew he had a history of firearms violations. Regarding the item in the mobile home, that was taken pursuant to an administrative warrant. They found a shotgun and some ammunition in there. Mr. Williams argued in his brief that the ammunition was the link showing the connection with Mr. Johnson. I submit that that is not entirely correct. When they seized the shotgun, they took all of the material that linked Mr. Johnson to that gun that was found in the bedroom, or linked him to that bedroom. In other words, there were some bills that were 5 or 6 months old that had previously been where he was living. However, they didn't take a photograph of the pants or sweatpants under which the shotgun was found, nor did they preserve it. And I think the same argument goes, that we could have presented that to Andre Reeves' brother, and his brother would have said, those are my brother's sweatpants. And I think that if you turn back to the...
What happened to the clothes? Why weren't they accessible to you in any event?
They gave them back to Andre Reeves.
The police gave the clothes to the other...
Right. They gave them back to him, returned them to him.
And then argued that the shotgun was Johnson?
Yes. Argued that the shotgun was Johnson's, and argued that the handgun was Johnson's. They said that the clothing was of no significance. They felt it's not important in this case, which I think is rather begging the question. If you find a weapon underneath somebody's clothes in their car or in a room that they have access to, he or she has access to, that is certainly relevant to the case and has a lot to do with who owns and or possesses the weapon. The argument as to the applicability of Lolly is basically the same in regards to whether the item is discoverable, whether there's a duty to preserve, whether there was a breach, and whether consequences are that will flow from that breach. There was no replacement for that evidence. I mean, we couldn't show it to Andre Reeves' brother, his wife who testified, or even the defendant to say, that's not my clothes.
Does the record indicate that Andre Reeves occupied this same room occasionally?
It indicates, yes, Your Honor, it does.
So Johnson used the room and Reeves also used the room?
Johnson used the room, and the testimony that was presented was that he moved out in January. The bills that were found went through January.
Right, 4 months earlier.
Right.
But what's the evidence that Reeves used the room?
Gary Bryan, who lived in the trailer, so then Andre Reeves came and stayed there on occasion.
In the same room.
In the same room.
Reeves was charged originally, then the charges were dropped, is
yes.
That correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But he was never charged with possession of a firearm by a person prohibited. The only person that was ever charged with that was Mr. Johnson.
Do you know what he was charged with?
He was charged with possession of marijuana, maintaining, I believe, and several other offenses. That there was one felony and they were dismissed at the preliminary hearing.
So does the record reflect how this incident was transformed from stopping Andre Reeves, known to the police as a person who possessed weapons, who in fact was driving a car with a weapon behind him, into him not being charged at all and the passenger being charged?
The rationale of the state was that Mr. Johnson attempted to flee, that the administrative warrant was executed and found the shotgun in a bedroom that was his, and they claimed he was still living there. So that's how you got to the point where they charged him and did not charge Mr. Reeves.
Well, the big question, I guess, is whether the trial court erred in not giving a Lolly instruction. There's no duty or obligation on the part of the court to do that unless there's a duty to preserve evidence as far as the state was concerned. And the state did not have a duty unless the evidence was material. So the question is whether the evidence was material. But that question has to be determined, does it not, from the standpoint of the police in real time. So what exactly is the lens through which we're supposed to decide this question?
Well,
the policeman did not, that is the officer that that was responsible for these events, did not believe it was material. The judge in the Superior Court didn't believe it was material. You contend that it was. By what standard do we assess those conflicting contentions?
Judge, I would just say that it's got to be a common sense standard. I mean, if you find a weapon underneath clothing in a vehicle that belongs to somebody, you have to preserve that evidence. It's relevant as to who possessed or owned the gun. The same argument applies to the sweatpants.
Mr. Whitehurst, there's some suggestion in the cases that the standard that could be used is either this is material that the state would be obligated to disclose under Superior Court Rule 16 as their discovery obligation, or it's Brady material.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not just a loose ad hoc standard.
Right.
And if they returned clothes to an individual that encased or enwrapped a shotgun in a building where he lived from time to time, would that, under a Rule 16 or a Brady analysis, be considered material to who owned and possessed the shotgun?
If they had the clothing, if they had kept it, certainly it would be. I mean, you could have the brother.
Well, they more than kept it, as I understand it. Maybe the state will dispute your statement of the facts, but at least the clothing that was covering or encasing the shotgun in the trailer was given to Reeves.
Was given back to him, yes.
Well, how is that not an indication on the police part that they believe that the clothes that covered the shotgun belonged to someone other than the person they arrested and the state indicted for possession of the shotgun?
Well, I think, Judge, it's clear that it's better to have somebody stand up there and say those were Andre Reeves' clothes. They were not Isaac Johnson's clothes.
No, I understand it's better. My point really is it had to be in the police mind that if even they believe the clothes belong to Reeves, it would be critical to the defense to have the same material available to identify that clothing covering the shotgun that belonged to Reeves to exclude Johnson from ownership and possession.
And what happened in this case was they initially identified Andre Reeves as a suspect for possession of the firearm by a person prohibited, but once Mr. Johnson attempted to run away and then they went and searched the mobile home, they changed the focus and focused solely on Mr. Johnson and not Mr. Reeves anymore.
Is there any significance to the way in which the shotgun was covered by the clothing?
Judge, as far as I know, it was just wrapped up in the clothing, and they seized all the items out of the room where the shotgun was found that implicated Mr. Johnson.
Well, that's what I was looking for, wrapped in the clothing.
Yes.
Not just clothing thrown loosely on top of the shotgun, but the shotgun was wrapped in the clothing.
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor. And in the car, it was placed under the clothing. Officer Matthews said he didn't think it had anything to do with who possessed or owned the weapon, and I think that's just not significant. I think it's wrong that it has something to do with it. It's material to who owns or possesses the weapon.
Mr. Whitehurst, is your, just to follow up on the Chief Justice's questions, is your contention that the clothing was Brady material?
Well, we couldn't.
Or Rule 16 material, or neither of the above.
It was Rule 16 material. If it had been seized, we would have been entitled to look at it. Now, we can't tell whether it's Brady material or not because we didn't have an opportunity to look at it and have somebody say
that. But that begs the question, doesn't it? Because there is no duty to seize it unless it's material. And so we're sort of, it's like a dog chasing its own tail.
And I think it's clear under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, that it is material. I mean, it's found, it's where the shotgun's found wrapped in it.
Mr. Whitehouse, how could it not be material, no pun intended, if the police returned it to someone as their clothing, inconsistent with the person they had arrested for owning the shotgun and possessing the shotgun, after finding the shotgun wrapped up in the clothing? People don't typically wrap up their property in someone else's clothes, do they?
No, Your Honor, and I can't answer that. I don't know why they specifically rejected the fact that it could have been Andre Reeves' gun and then focused on Isaac Johnson, except they thought he tried to run away from them, and that when they executed the administrative warrant, they found the weapon.
Can we go back to what the police did with this clothing, which was to return it to Reeves? Did that come out in the trial?
Yes.
And were the police asked, basically, you know, why did you give this clothing back to Reeves? I assume the answer was because it was his clothing, right?
I know that as far as the clothing that was found in the car, it was returned to Andre Reeves.
And
the
what,
sweatpants, I don't know.
You mean the clothing that the shotgun was wrapped in, you don't know?
So you don't know what the police did with it?
Well, they didn't have it. I know that. They did not have the sweatpants.
And did you ask? I mean,
yes, I asked. There was an administrative warrant executed by a probation officer.
Right, I understand.
And he found certain items in there.
Right.
And took the sweatpants, I assume, but then nobody, you know, I don't know whether they were specifically returned to...
Well, isn't that a question you could have asked the police, you know, what happened to it?
Well, I'm assuming they were returned to Reeves with all the other clothing. But
that's not part of the record.
Well, it says the clothing was returned to Reeves in the record. Not, I don't know if I specifically asked whether the sweatpants were returned or not.
So I assume you were able to pursue a line of questioning and an argument to the jury that said the police treated the clothing as it being Reeves. The clothing was wrapped around these guns. Reeves is known to be a person who owns guns. There's no reason to assume that these guns belong to my client as opposed to Reeves.
Yes,
right?
Yes, ma'am. I pursued that argument vigorously. And, but I don't think that replaces an instruction by the court, if it's appropriate, saying you should consider this evidence favorable to the defendant. Moving on to the DNA.
Well, I just want to clear up one thing, because I had made the assumption in my last question that the record reflected that the sweatpants wrapped around the shotgun were sweatpants the police returned to Reeves as if they were his.
That's my understanding too, Judge.
But does the record support that? Other than your general comment that they gave the clothing to whatever
no,
that may
no,
mean.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
The only thing that's supported by the record is that they did not keep the sweatpants, nor did they photograph the sweatpants.
Hey, did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court.
Before you get started,
yes.
can you perhaps enlighten us on this factual issue about what happened to the clothing, and particularly the clothing that was found underneath the bed wrapped around the gun? There's a suggestion that all of that clothing was seized in the first instance, and then the clothing was returned to Reeves. Is that correct, or do we not know what happened to it?
Well, I think we know partially what happened to it. The clothing, there's clothing at two different
right.
locations. One's in a mobile home, and the other is in the car.
Right.
The clothing in the car, my understanding was that clothing under which the 25 caliber handgun was located was returned to Mr. Reeves by the police. That was
meaning it had first been seized and then returned.
Well, I don't know if it was ever seized. I mean, it was there, and the handgun was underneath of it. The handgun was seized, and There was a sock in the car that had shotgun shells, and those items were seized.
Well, they didn't whistle to the handgun, and it jumped out from under the clothes, right?
Oh, no. They took the handgun and took it back to the police station. The record, I don't think, reveals what happened to the clothing in the mobile home. There were sweat clothes wrapped around a shotgun.
Before you get to the mobile home, at least as I understood your answer, you left the clothes in the car. At least I understand your answer to be somebody lifted up the clothes, saw a gun, and took the gun, seized the gun, and just left the clothes there. And yet, we had the impression before your answer that the clothes and the gun were both taken from the car, and later the clothes were given to Reeves.
I'm not sure about the record on that. It may be that the latter may have occurred. The police ultimately did not retain the clothing, however long they may have had it, the clothing in the car. The clothing back in the mobile home, that was actually a search by a probation officer. He went there, and I don't know what happened to that clothing in the mobile home. The record isn't clear if that was simply left at the mobile home or if it was seized by the probation officer. What was definitely seized in the mobile home was a shotgun. I think it was a 12-gauge shotgun, and some 25 caliber ammunition. And it was this ammunition that is the causal connection between the two firearms. There's ammunition in the car, and there's ammunition in the mobile home. There's a handgun in the car and a shotgun in the mobile home, but the ammunition that fits the respective weapons is at different locations. The ammunition in the car is the shotgun shells, but the shotgun itself is back at the mobile home. The firearm in the car is a handgun, a 25 caliber handgun. The 40 rounds of 25 caliber ammunition is found under the bed in the front bedroom that was occupied by Mr. Johnson and listed with probation as his residence address.
Okay, but the problem I think we're all having with this is that we understand that there were weapons and there was ammunition, and the ammunition matched the different weapons. And some of the evidence was found in Reeves' car, and some of the evidence was found under a bed that both Reeves and Johnson used as a place to sleep, right? I mean, there's no dispute about that, is there?
No, I think that's all correct.
So arguably what we have is one of these two guys had some weapons, or maybe they both did, but what places Johnson as the guilty one, or are you relying simply on the fact that he ran, so he must be the guilty one?
Well, I think that's part of it. He ran, and not only did he run from the police and have to be, he was in handcuffs when he ran, and had to be subdued with a taser, but he was running toward the location where the mobile home was. The stop was in close proximity to where the mobile home was. The other thing, I think, is that what else was discovered under the bed, there was, I think there was a computer bag or something like that, and then in that, under the bed, there was mail addressed to Mr. Johnson, as well as this ammunition. The ammunition...
Well, that brings me to my question about the state's ultimate position here. Are you saying in this case these clothes, both locations, simply were insignificant?
Yes, I think they were not material or probative to the central fact that had to be resolved. That was
the reason I ask that is because I know you don't make the record, and you're certainly not involved in gathering evidence. But we hear arguments by the state all the time, and we've heard many arguments where they find something in a closet, and the argument to our court by the state is, it was really significant that this item was found in the closet with the defendant's clothes. Just 2 weeks ago, we heard an argument that said, oh, it was really significant that this item was found in the defendant's jacket. that you just told us 30 seconds ago, it's really significant that they found the shotgun next to the defendant's mail. Why isn't it significant that maybe the shotgun was in Reeves' clothes? Why isn't it significant that the gun in the car was in Reeves' clothes? We're going to somehow have to reconcile our precedents. And I suspect the state doesn't want us to write an opinion that says, notwithstanding all of our prior precedents, we've concluded the proximity of the defendant's clothes to the incriminating evidence is really insignificant. So the police can just stop worrying about making any notations with regard to the defendant's clothes and the proximity to the illegal evidence because it has no probative value. You certainly don't want us to write that, do you?
No. And I think the answer is what this court said, is that it's a totality of the circumstances approach when you're looking at missing evidence instructions. You have to look at it, everything that's involved here. Some cases it may be of significance, other cases it's not.
Well, tell us in this case, where we have all these other cases that say it's important that it was the item was in the closet with the defendant's clothes. It was particularly significant that the item was in the defendant's clothes. You want us to say here, but in this case, it really doesn't matter whose clothes the weapons were wrapped in. What's the rest of that sentence? Because why?
Because it doesn't prove who had possession of the firearms. Even if those clothes belonged to Mr. Johnson, that still in itself wouldn't prove possession in this particular case, because you've got these two individuals. They're both friends, and apparently they spend.
But is that the issue, Mr. Williams? Isn't the issue whether or not it would be material to the defense to be able to examine and perhaps gather evidence from the testimony of someone else about the ownership of the clothes, and be fundamentally important to the defense opportunity to rebut testimony that suggests circumstantial evidence shows that the weapons were possessed by Mr. Johnson? It's not so much what you need to prove X. In this situation, as I understand it, either under discoverable material under Rule 16 or Brady, it's the question is whether or not it would be material to the defense to have access to this material.
Right. In this case, I don't think it is material.
Well, one of the issues that's troubled me for years, both in Brady and in this arena, is there seems to be an almost unstated or inarticulated presumption that the state makes that decision. The state unilaterally decides what is discoverable, what is material, and what is Brady material at the end of the day. And they either don't let the defense know about it until the last minute when the defense can't really utilize it in any meaningful way, or they never find out about it. Now, this is a perfect example of where the state's decided that it's immaterial that the handgun was covered with clothing belonged to the driver and owner of the car. The state unilaterally decides it's insignificant that the shotgun is found in a bedroom used by two different people, one of whom is charged with a crime, the other isn't charged with the crime of possessing a weapon. And the state unilaterally decides it's insignificant that the shotgun is wrapped up in sweatpants that may well belong to the person they've chosen not to charge. Why does the state get to make this unilateral decision?
Well, I guess because in the first instance, if they've actually seized the items, they have possession of them, and then they have to make a determination if it's Brady to turn it over. If they haven't seized the items under Rule 16, they don't have any obligation because they never seized them.
Let's approach it another way. If it's a 6,000-ton dump truck, It might be difficult for them to keep it in their possession on the possibility that may be material to the defense. But here we're dealing with something that's very difficult to argue. It would be onerous for the police to keep it temporarily, disclose it in response to Rule 16, or otherwise disclose it as Brady material, or even independently take it to the court and ask the court for a judgment. What's the burden on the state to retain something that wraps, that enwraps a shotgun when the issue in the case is the ownership of the shotgun?
Well, I think the responsibility of the, and there were two different searches, one by the police and one by the probation officer, is if there is any obvious connection, any material or probative value of the item. If there isn't, then there isn't an obligation to seize it. That's what the trial court found, and the state's position is that that ruling was correct. That finding out who owned this clothing, whether it was Mr. Reeves or the accused, was still not going to answer the fundamental factual question of whose weapons these were, who has possession of the weapons. And it's a constructive possession case here.
Would you agree that if it's not the clincher, that it's at least material to a defense who will be presenting other facts consistent with no possession on the part of Mr. Johnson? It doesn't have to, in and of itself, establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was Mr. Johnson's. But that's not really the issue. The issue is, would it have been material to the defense in presenting a case rebutting the state's position that the weapon was owned or possessed by, but put ownership on the shelf, it was possessed by Mr. Johnson?
No, I still don't think so, because there are ways to do it. I mean, Mr. Reeves could certainly have testified that he wasn't charged with things ultimately.
Do you think a lawyer would have allowed him to testify under circumstances where a shotgun was found wrapped up in his sweatpants in a bedroom where he on occasion sleeps? You think anybody's going to let him testify?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it wasn't his shotgun, whatever happened to his sweatpants, I mean, that's not a crime if someone uses his sweatpants.
The argument here is we still don't know that it isn't his shotgun.
Well, the jury found that Mr. Johnson was in possession of the shotgun.
The jury found he was in possession of it. We still don't know who owned it.
Who ultimately owned it? No, I don't know. I mean, I don't think there was, document.
And if you were representing Mr. Reeves, you would say, go ahead and testify that those were your sweatpants, which were wrapped around a shotgun in a bedroom where you occasionally slept. Mm-hmm. You're not suggesting that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what they would do. I mean, Mr. Reeves wasn't charged. There was, I think, some testimony about an emblem on a shirt that was in the car, and there was testimony, I think, that Mr. Reeves worked for a relative in a landscape or lawn service or something, and that there were similar type uniforms they wore with those things. So I think there was some connection presented at trial about clothing in the car and a connection with Mr. Reeves, but I don't think there was anything one way or the other about whose sweat clothes these ultimately were that were wrapped around the shotgun. That was just left where it was. And Detective Robbins, he testified that, well, the importance here or the causal connection of all this was not clothing, but the ammunition and the weapons, that the ammunition at different locations fit the weapons at different locations, and that was the reason that Mr. Johnson was being charged.
Well, and that, I think, was the point of the Chief Justice's question. You have two people that occupy the room where the ammunition appears to be significant. Do you think it would have made a difference to the jury if Johnson could say, look, I was a passenger in Reeves' car. I didn't even see this gun because it was covered by his clothes in the seat behind him. And he could make a fairly strong case that he wasn't in possession of the weapon because he couldn't see it, and it was hidden by Reeves' clothes.
Well, I think that's, certainly a compelling argument that can be made to the jury, and then the jury just has to decide under the totality of circumstances whether or not that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that's what we're trying to relate here. If it's a compelling argument that could be made to the jury, then it would appear under our standards of what you should preserve, to be something that's material. If it's the basis for a compelling argument to the defense, as the Chief Justice said, One way to look at it is, did the state prove its case? And we'll assume, under all of our standards, you had a prima facie case and you get to the jury. What central to this appeal is, should something have been made available to the defense that was not made available to the defense?
Right, and I don't think there was any obligation to seize the clothes because there wasn't an obvious connection between who owned the clothes and who owned the weapon. They just happened to both be at the same or approximately the same location on the back seat of the car, and in the mobile home, there were sweatpants wrapped around the shotgun.
I'm trying to understand the state's thought process with regard to Reeves, again, based on all the cases we've heard in the past. Mm-hmm. I could imagine a situation where Reeves was charged, and the evidence would be we stopped Reeves. He was known to possess weapons. He was driving the car. They were his clothes. The car, the gun was immediately behind him on the driver's side, and whatever else you would say, but it seems like a pretty strong case against Reeves.
Well, I think initially that was the suspicion, but I think the clincher became the next morning when the administrative search was done at the mobile home, and the ammunition that fit the handgun was actually found under the bed where Mr. Johnson had listed his address for the probation department as being his home address. That was the real connection.
The same bed where Reeves sometimes slept.
Well, he was there. I guess Gary Bryan said he was there from time to time. I don't know if he slept there or was in the room or what. I think there was actually a picture of Mr. Reeves in the bedroom or something holding the shotgun at some point. So, and that was, something that the defense argued about, too, is, look, it must be his shotgun. He's got his picture taken with it. And those arguments were all made to the jury, and the jury had to resolve these conflicting views of the evidence, and that's what it was. But the point here is that whether or not they're entitled to a DeBerry-Lolly missing evidence instruction, and the state's position is, well, they weren't entitled to it because there wasn't any obligation to collect the clothing. And it wasn't material or probative of the central factual issue. And then second was the argument about the DNA, and I'll try to address that if there are
one more question.
Certainly.
If we assume that the record supports the shotgun found at the mobile home found wrapped in someone's sweatpants, if it had been found in a gun case with initials on it, would the police have determined that the gun case with the initials would be somehow material to who might possess or own the gun?
I think that's certainly safe to say they would have done that, sure.
Why is it such a logical leap to say that the owner, possessor, or sometime wearer of the sweatpants found wrapped around a gun, serving arguably as a protective device for the weapon or a gun case, why wouldn't it be equally material?
Well, I think the problem is identifying whose sweatpants they were, and I don't know if there was any testimony that...
Well, but if you're the state and you don't keep the sweatpants, you no longer have a problem. Nobody can identify whose they are. But if you save them because they're wrapped around the gun and the defense gets access to them, the defense would then possibly be able to say, either through testing of some kind or simple identification by somebody who'd seen an individual wearing them or something similar to that, those aren't Mr. Johnson's sweatpants. Those are Mr. Reeves' sweatpants. But the state solves that problem by letting the sweatpants disappear, correct?
As far as I know, they were never seized. They were just left.
Well, if the shotgun was seized and the sweatpants were wrapped around it, how do you seize the shotgun without seizing the sweatpants?
Well, I think they took the shotgun out of the trailer, and I don't know that anyone ever took the sweatpants out. They took the shotgun and the ammunition.
Oh, okay. They didn't actually seize it until they were out of the trailer? Look, when they picked the thing up, it's got a sweatpants wrapped around it.
Right.
If it were inserted in a gun sleeve or a gun case, it would be the same thing. They remove the covering of object from the shotgun. Do they not have to seize the covering object in order to seize the shotgun?
Oh, yeah, I think temporarily, sure, there was a seizure, I guess.
Okay, and they solved their identification problem and their link with ownership by just dumping the sweatpants and moving out with the shotgun. And the question here is, by doing so, did they deprive the defense of something that would be material to disproving the element of knowing possession or ownership of the shotgun?
No, because proving the ownership of the sweatpants still doesn't prove who possessed the shotgun.
But proving ownership of a gun case would.
Well, it would be a little it would be a little tougher case, certainly, and that's why it's a totality of the circumstances case, or circumstances approach, rather. You know, what is it that the weapon is encased in? If it's this gun case that's customized and has initials, and those are the initials of the suspect, well, that's certainly pretty compelling. If it's just sweatpants, they may be the defendant's, they may be someone else's, but that doesn't, that is not as close a causal link or close as a question or connection, rather. And that's what's involved. The if there's any other question, I'll try to answer those. If not, I'll move to the DNA. The DNA, what was done here was the police, approximately 2 weeks after the seizure of the two weapons, Officer Bumgardner did a DNA swab of the two weapons, the handgun and the shotgun, and then the police got a search warrant to get a DNA sample from the accused in this case. Was a 10-day search warrant. Unfortunately, before they could execute the search warrant, Mr. Johnson had been released from custody. The search warrant then expired. The police attempted in September, I think September 22nd, they got a second search warrant to get a comparison DNA sample to see if they could connect Mr. Johnson to the weapons by showing that his DNA was deposited on one or both of the weapons. Unfortunately, they never executed the second search warrant. The officer said that after it was obtained September 22nd, they realized that approximately a week earlier, September 15, the court had already set a November 2nd trial date, and the police thought that they did not have sufficient time at that point to get the DNA analysis done, even if they could get the comparison. In this particular case, I don't think they're, that entitles Mr. Johnson to a DeBerry-Lally instruction either, because the testing was not completed here. There's no legal obligation upon the police to do any particular testing of items that are seized here, and I think that's where the whole thing lies. If the police had some of the evidence, and the testing certainly could have been done by Mr. Johnson if he wanted to furnish his own sample to his expert and have the expert.
Let me follow up on that particular point. Did Mr. Johnson know from the outset that the state had DNA samples from the weapons so that he was aware, if he chose to, that he could do some comparison testing?
Well, I haven't reviewed the discovery response, but I would assume that, you know, that would have been indicated in the discovery response that we have DNA swabs from these two weapons, but we don't have a comparison sample.
Okay.
You know, that's as much as I know. If there's any other questions, I'll try to answer.
Do you see any significance to the letter that Mr. Whitehurst sent with the attachment that wasn't part of the briefing?
Well, it wasn't in the record. It wasn't developed, and I was in Wilmington all day yesterday. I had another hearing with Judge Vaughn, and didn't get back till about 7. But it looks like at page 6 on this that when Mr. Johnson was taken to the prison took a DNA sample, and I asked the prosecutor. She isn't in this morning, but I sent her an email, and she gave me a response. She said that the Dover PD had no idea that the DNA testing was taken by the probation and parole, and what she also said was that this is trial prosecutor now. Furthermore, had they known that PNP, probation and parole, had a sample, they would still have had to get their own. They have been, they meaning the Dover police, have been told that they cannot use Department of Correction DNA samples for comparisons. One detective told me that they do not have the same chain of custody requirements as the police, but I've not had this confirmed with the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. So, you know, that's kind of where we are on that. But I, as far as I know, wasn't introduced as an exhibit, but there's no reason to think that it's not valid. There may have been a sample taken from him, that's what the record indicates, at the prison, but apparently the Dover police didn't know that. Obviously, if they had known it, they wouldn't be running around trying to get two search warrants to get the sample that was already there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honors, just briefly in rebuttal, Mr. Williams said that Detective Robbins testified that the ammunition that was found is the link that established the possession of the weapon, yet they take a DNA swab on the weapon some 15 days after the arrest. They attempt to get one search warrant, don't even try to get it approved by a judge at all. Then have conversations with the prosecutor, submit another search warrant that has a different paragraph in it that says this is necessary to help prove or disprove possession. So I think it begs...
A search warrant for what? DNA evidence?
DNA sample from Mr. Johnson.
Okay.
That's what they want to judge. So I think that his testimony is... you know, it gives me pause for concern, and I would think it would give you pause for concern, too. If they don't think the DNA is important, why are they trying to get search warrants for it? And I think it's clear that it was important, and by their own language, they said it's helpful or necessary to prove or disprove possession, not ownership, possession of a weapon.
Thank you, Mr. Weathering. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.